Welcome to the Pop Culture Pod Podcast. Now let's begin.
You're making me nervous. Looking for my car keys and painkillers. Tropical sweat and two little fingers. I know I should have ghosted that too, but I waited it out for you. Wish I knew the way things were between us. I'm broken, I beg a bad idea. Every time I'm thinking of you, I'm trying to stay cool in the downtown weather. Wondering if you think of me ever. You know how to love me better. It's got me feeling I'm not the lover. I can't get you off of my mind. Why do I keep wasting my time? Man, you make it easy for me. So why can't I make you love me? Love me. Don't know like it. 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 Why can't I make you love me? Leaving me hanging. So I'ma play cool when you think I would then.
Well, hello, fellow podcast listener, and welcome to the Pop Culture Pub Podcast. I am your host. My name is Chris Lockhart. And joining me this evening is my co-host in crime, Mr. Kevin Decent. How's it going, Kevin?
It's going all right, Chris. Much like our topic tonight, I think we need to look on the bright side of things that seem terrible.
Yes. That being said, at the time of this recording, it is March 25th, 2020, and we're in the midst of the corona pandemic right now. So, Kevin and I are still in good health, and so far so good, fingers crossed. We're going to get through this, but we actually have two episodes planned this week, so there'll be two coming, and who knows, maybe in the future we might do a few more recordings if we're all isolated and whatnot. Like, where you're at, Kevin, right now, are you guys all, like, isolated right now? Like, you're not supposed to go out and all that kind of stuff?
For the most part, I'm in New York, and listeners in the States will realize, you for Canada might not realize, and anyone else around the world, but there's a difference between states' rights and a federal right. So okay. Right now, each state is deciding what they want to close, when, and for how long, depending on how big and bad their outbreak is of this.
Yeah.
So New York right now is 100% closure for any business deemed non-essential. And any that are essential are the ones you would expect, grocery stores, pharmacies, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. So mine is not essential, so we're closed until ? Mm-hmm. And that depends. We made a decision on our own to close up, but then the governor has extended things, and everything's kind of up in the air. So it's ? Stay home right now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's kind of...
Schools close until the 16th or 15th, I think.
Oh, really? See, where I'm at, because I'm in Alberta in Canada, for the foreseeable, schools are closed till September, which really sucks.
Because it's probably coming for us.
Yeah.
Some states have already done it.
Yeah, it really sucks because, like, my oldest daughter, she's graduating this year, and, you know, her grad's in question, you know, like, if they're going to even have ceremonies, because they don't, you know, no big social gatherings are allowed. And, like, yeah, the grocery stores, gas stations, that sort of thing are still open, pharmacies. I don't think they've, like, it's kind of the same thing here where the federal government can dictate things. Like, now I think the most recent thing that they've said is that if you do any traveling, you now have to quarantine. Like, there's no questions asked, and if you leave your house, you will be charged, that sort of thing, right?
We're not there yet, because today, like, I end up having to go grocery store multiple times for different things. It's one of those situations where you're home and an hour later you realize something else you need.
Yep.
That you wish you knew an hour ago, but you know, that happens. And I did a quick drop off at the post office today too.
Yeah.
So far that's still running.
Yeah, I did a grocery store run, and then I went by Subway to buy subs for our supper. But Subway, you can't dine in. You're not allowed to eat in. It's just takeout, and you have to stay 6 feet away from them. Like, you're not allowed near.
Yep.
So.
Ours removed all the chairs, so you can't even sit down if you wanted to.
Yeah, they stacked them all and put them all to the side. So yeah, and they got signs up all over the place saying that you're not allowed to stay and dine in. I think other restaurants they're limiting the number of people they're allowed. Like, you know, if it's a restaurant that can have like say a capacity of like 50 people, the most they're allowed now is 25. I believe that's how it works. But you still have to keep 2 meters away and all that kind of stuff, right? But yeah, it's getting crazy out there. The Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo, like that's the convention that I typically go to every year. It's now postponed until maybe the summer. Which doesn't entirely break my heart because I would prefer it to be in the summer. Just because where I live in Alberta, especially by Calgary, because it's so close to the Rocky Mountains, like last year because the convention's at the end of April, it's the last weekend in April, and the Saturday of the convention, they literally had a blizzard snowstorm. And then we had to leave on the Sunday, and it was terrible road conditions, really, really bad. But the one year I went, it was 2011. For some reason, it also got delayed till the summer, and it was so much better because, you know, you can walk around in your shorts and t-shirts and you know, like it was nice. You could be outside so much. It's so much better when the conventions are in the summer, I think. My only problem is this summer I already have a lot of my weekends planned already because we got different things going on. So I'm hoping it doesn't fall on a weekend where, you know, I have, like, my family reunion or whatever, right? So, fingers crossed, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we're not even planning anything ahead at all right now, because who knows?
Yeah.
You know, the amount of stuff, the dates have changed, or they're going to be moved, postponed, you know, stuff happening at the same time. And honestly, like, I just hope people don't try to do too much at once.
Yeah.
You know, they're all excited. So let's have 100 parties this weekend. No. No. Have one.
Well,
let's ease back into it.
Well, the thing with me is my previous employer, you basically had to plan your summer holidays basically after Christmas. Like you had to plan your year, right? Because you had to book your holidays, and people started booking their holidays like January 1st. Or January 2nd, whatever the day was when we came back. And so I'm just used to that. I'm just used to, you know, looking at the calendar. Okay, we're planning on going to Drumheller to check out the Dinosaur Museum this summer. That's our big trip, I think. So I kind of had, that weekend planned out. And then we're having a family reunion on my mom's side. So we got that weekend booked up. You know, that's just the way I am. Like, I'm just, I always plan ahead. But yeah, now with this COVID-19 epidemic, for the Calgary convention, I actually had to cancel some of my holiday days that I was going to use to go there because I don't need to use them anymore. So, anyway, hopefully we get past this sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I agree.
Because yeah, I it's funny, like now they like up here, and I'm sure this is like where you're at as well, you know, they say, you know you're supposed to self-isolate, stay at home, don't go out, you know, keep your social distance, blah blah blah, all that kind of stuff. which, you know, whatever. Like, I mean, there's, you know, some days, some weeks, you know, I just hang out at home. Like, you know, like, that's just the way it is. But when people tell you you can't go out, then it's like, it seems worse somehow. It's like, you know, I want to go out. I want to do things. But you can't, there's nothing to do. Even if you could. You know, all, like, up here, all the movie theaters are closed. All the museums are closed. You know, a lot of the public attractions are closed. Like, it's very unfortunate.
I've been thinking that too, but we've had most of our life being constantly told, you have to do this, and you have to go to work, and you have to go here, and you have to go there, and that's life, and this is what you have to do. And to be told, don't do it, is like, wait, I need to completely go against everything the world has trained my brain to do all my life, and it's tough to slip a switch, really, and completely change. Exactly. And then knowing, and eventually go back to it, too.
Yeah.
Like, right when we're used to this is going to be when stuff starts going back to normal.
Yeah. But, like I said, hopefully we get past this. And apparently this was, like, predicted in a Dean Koontz book, apparently.
I saw that, too.
But the thing is, like, I mean, the CDC was saying, like, I know there was, like, they did some press conference, like, I think back in 2008, and they were saying, like, this is going to happen, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to have a pandemic. Like, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. So, you know, I know, a lot, like, in this Dean Koontz book, I'm not sure which one it is, but apparently he said, like, you know, spring 2020, there's going to be a pandemic. In the summer, it'll kind of go away. And, you know, people let their guard down. And then in the fall, it's going to come back worse than it did in the spring. And then I think he said, like, it'll come back, like, in a year or two. And then it'll be gone forever. Like, we'll never see it again. So, but, just, it's interesting. It's interesting that, you know, these things are happening. You know, The Simpsons, you know, predicting the future. Like, it's, but, anyway. Let's move on to our main topic this evening. And for our main topic, it's called Awful But Good. So these are some things that, you know, maybe in hindsight, look back and you're like, oh man, that was terrible. But yet I liked it. Or, you know, you'll hear someone talking and they're, you know, bashing something and you're like, no, wait a second. That's actually good what you're talking about. You know, what you're saying is crazy talk here. So we have some examples of things that may be considered awful, yet good. And this was actually something, I want to say the Nerd Lunch podcast. I don't know if this was an actual topic that they did, but I know they did an episode years ago where they talked about Buckaroo Banzai, the movie. And, you know, they loved it, right? And I had never seen it, right? So out of curiosity, I was like, okay, I got to check out this movie. You know, these guys are, you know, they say it's bad, but it's good at the same time. And I watched it. Unfortunately, I just saw bad. You know, I mean, I love Peter Weller. Clancy Brown's great. You know, like, I think maybe if I'd seen this in the 80s when it was originally released, I might have liked it, and it might have held a special place in my heart like it did for those guys, but to me it's just awful. But so what I'm saying is, for Kevin and I, some of our things that we have on our list may be awful to you, but we find them good, and maybe you will too, who knows. So I'll kick it off, Kev. The first on my list is there's a TV show that came out in the 90s called Babylon 5. It was created by J. Michael Straczynski. It lasted 5 seasons on television. Every year they were on the bubble. Every year they didn't know if they were going to get renewed. They were always on the brink of cancellation. The first 4 seasons were in syndication. The last season was on TNT. You know, it It's a space science fiction series that takes place on a space station called Babylon 5. And it's basically like a great epic novel in space. You know, there's a beginning, a middle, a climax to the series, and an end that takes place during those five seasons that the show was on the air. And, you know, like Star Trek, it, you know, they have, you know, the humans, you know, instead of the, you know, Starfleet, it's the Earth Alliance. You know, they have different alien races. They have the Minbari, the Centauri, the Narn, the Vorlons. They have a mysterious enemy called the Shadows. They had a lot of obstacles to get through when they initially came on the air, because, you know, they were competing against, at the time, like when season one of Babylon 5 came out, season seven of Next Generation was airing, season two of Deep Space Nine was airing. Babylon 5 previously had a TV movie which had very mixed reviews. Me in particular, I didn't like it. I thought it was terrible. But they got greenlit to do a season of television, and then you know, they got greenlit, you know, for every other season after that. But like I said, they were always on the bubble. But they had a lot of world building to do. They had a lot, you know, they had a lot of things to establish. They had to round out 22 episodes, because I believe their seasons were 22 episodes back in those days for Babylon 5. And it was pretty clear they didn't have the same budget that, you know, Deep Space Nine had. They definitely didn't have the special effects that Deep Space Nine had. So they had a lot going against them. And season one, you know, aside from a handful of episodes, really is not that good on Babylon 5. But they tried their hardest. They really did. And like I said, there were some very awesome standout episodes, which were amazing, I think. But some of the, you know, the choices, the narrative choices they made, the special effects in particular in the first season were very bad. Like the CGI was not very good. And I should point out, this is one of the first series to go strictly CGI. Like, everything was computer generated. The station was computer generated. All the ships, all the star fields, space battles. There was no models built. It was all CGI special effects. The first season was really rough. It was really rough. They had a character, I want to say his name was Nagrath. He was basically a giant alien grasshopper looking dude. And he was, I think he was supposed to be like the Jabba the Hutt of this, you know, sector of space. Like he ran the underground. And it was really, really bad. Like, I mean, it would have been like, it's one of those, you know, realistic, puppets, Muppets, whatever you want to call them. That would look cool if you saw it at a convention. You'd be like, oh, that's kind of cool. But it really looks bad on screen. But they went with it. You know, like a lot of makeup for their different alien races were kind of out there in the beginning, but they kind of reined it in a little bit as the series progressed. But, you know, once you get, and one of our guest podcasters that comes on here every once in a while, Rich, I remember a few years ago he was watching season one after I had recommended Babylon 5, and he said, Chris, like, dude, I don't know if I can get through this. This is, like, so cheesy. Like, and I'm like, Rich, you got to get, you know, get through season one. Season two gets better, so much better, leaps and bounds better. And then season three, it really takes off. And it's, you know, but you got, you know, that first season is very, very rough. And some behind-the-scenes things as well. The lead actor, Michael O'Hara, who played Commander Sinclair, he was going through some personal struggles during that first season. And it was later revealed it had to do with some mental health issues, which is why he doesn't come back as the lead in season two. They cast Bruce Boxleitner as Captain Sheridan in season two, and he became the series lead for the remaining four seasons, with Michael O'Hara coming back for a couple episodes, or for an episode in season two, he come back for a cameo, and then in season three, he came back for a two-part episode, which was awesome. But that first season, it's so bad. But I'm telling you, if you can get through it, there are some gems in that season, and if you can get through it, it gets so much better, so much better. But Kev, what are your thoughts on Babylon 5? Did you watch it at all when it was on the air?
I never did it. It's a huge hole in my pop culture knowledge, especially because I love J. Michael Straczynski as a writer of other things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he did Rising Stars at Top Cow Image, I think.
Yep.
Published it, which was fantastic comic story. Midnight Nation after that. There's a brand new comic company. Actually, I got to write up an article sometime soon of my picks of the month before the month is over.
Okay. And
Diamond stops shipping. Mm-hmm. But, there's a brand new company called AWA. It's like Artists Writers Alliance or something like that. And he has a new space alien apocalyptic comic coming from them too.
Hmm.
So I've always enjoyed his comic work and other stuff, but for some reason I've never sat down Babylon 5. And maybe it is. Maybe I've only seen, because I've tried before. I'm like, this just isn't for me, I guess. But I didn't realize the difference between season one and later seasons.
Oh yeah, like,
but,
like
for sitcoms, I know it. Parks and Rec, mm-hmm, is a big one. You have to struggle through that first season, and then they can find themselves, and it's a fantastic show.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done The Office. I'm the last person left, I guess. But everyone says you have to get through the first season of The Office, and then that takes off and becomes a great show as well. And there's lots of shows that just need a season or two to find themselves and then get good. So maybe Babylon, when I've tried, was first season stuff. And, you know, I never knew that fell under the same category of get through this and then it's worth it.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, there's a few gems in there in the first season. Like, I want to say out of the 22 episodes, there probably is 6 or 7 episodes that are really good. But yeah, you really have to get through that first season. But like I said, you know, for a show that's this epic in scale, like, I mean, it was competing against Deep Space Nine, right? And Deep Space Nine had the benefit of all this world building took place before that show even came on the air. Like, you know, you go into Deep Space Nine, you know who the Bajorans are, you know who the Cardassians are, you know who Starfleet is. You know, even some of the characters, like Chief O'Brien, like, you know who he is. You've seen him before. You know, and later when Worf joined the show, same thing. Whereas these guys were creating, you know, this whole new world with new uniforms, new settings, new sets, completely from scratch, and all the backstories. You know, like, you know, there's a lot of analogies, is that the right word? A lot of real world symbolism here. Like, you know, the Narns kind of represent, you know, the Jews in our world, you know, and the Centauri were basically like the Nazis, you know, like they enslaved.
So kind of like Roddenberry did well, but Lucas did poorly?
Yes, yeah. Like, J. Michael Straczynski is an amazing writer, and he's actually, as far as I know, like, I know he used to have the Guinness record for this series for most consecutive episodes written by one writer for a TV series. Because basically, like, the first season, he had some writers coming in, season two, Peter David wrote 2 episodes, you know, Larry DiTilio wrote some episodes. Like, a lot of his friends from the comic community and from his other projects, like, because he was a writer on the original Masters of the Universe cartoon. He was also a writer on Captain Power. So some of his friends from those other projects came to Babylon 5. DC Fontana, I believe, wrote a couple episodes as well. But basically, like, at some point during just after the beginning part of season two, he just took over, like, writing full-time. Like, he was basically a one-man writing staff for most of season two, all of season three, all of season four, and I think he wrote all of season five except for, like, two episodes or three episodes. Like, Neil Gaiman wrote one episode. I think it was Neil Gaiman wrote one episode in season five for Babylon 5. And I want to say, oh, I can't remember. Someone, Peter David maybe wrote an episode in season five. I can't remember. But for most of this series, J. Michael Straczynski was a one-man writing staff. And what he was able to accomplish is absolutely outstanding. The unfortunate side of it is there's a few tropes that come in there. Like, it's Straczynski-isms, I like to call them, where characters say the same lines. Different characters on the show repeat the same lines on different episodes. You know, unfortunately, that's a side effect of, you know, it being just one writer writing everything. You know, sometimes he can repeat himself, right? And because these are different lines for different characters, you know, they don't realize they're repeating a line that was said by someone else. Like, one thing that is repeated a lot in Babylon 5 is the line, "It's too late." You hear that multiple, like, so many times in the show. "It's too late. It's too late." There's others, but that's one that pops out in my mind. But that being said, first season overall is kind of awful. It really is, but there is a charm there. You know, like, they're trying. And like I said, like, the special effects were a work in progress, and it really did get better in season two, and especially in the later seasons when you have, like, the big epic space battles that you see in season four in particular. There's one epic battle in season three, which is awesome as well. But it gets so much better. But you just got to get through that first season. Once you get past that, you know, it's good times. And I will say, the season one finale, it was pretty awesome. It didn't end on a cliffhanger, but it did end with certain things not resolved, and you did have to come back for season two to find out what happened. And Straczynski, being the genius that he is, some of those things don't get resolved until, like, I think it was like the second episode of season two. So it's not like a quick resolution. But like I said, Babylon 5 season one, it's awful, but so good at the same time. So, Kev, I'll throw it over to you. What's first on your list, sir?
All right. It's funny because you kind of dropped it a little bit unknowingly with mentioning that Straczynski wrote some of the episodes of Masters of the Universe.
Yep.
Because I'm doing kind of a catch-all for 80s cartoons.
Okay.
And not all of them, but there's so many examples across the board. And it's stuff that, as a kid, you know, it's just a cartoon. It's fun, it's enjoyable, it's action-packed, you want to buy the toys, that's it. But as many of us revisited these things as adults, whether on DVD or streaming or, you know, whatever it may have been, There's so many episodes across the board for all your 80s action cartoons that are terrible. And you're rewatching it going, I can't believe I watched this. I feel dumber watching it now.
Yep.
I feel, you know, written down to. I feel like it was phoned in. I feel like they didn't care. And you still have an enjoyment and a love of it from your childhood. And then you have to watch another one because you know there's good episodes. And there is. There's a lot of them where you're like, wow, that was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe one day I'll deep dive and find out who wrote the good ones and who wrote the terrible ones and see if there's any crossover. But there's stuff like G.I. Joe. Snake Eyes is hiding undercover, and he puts on like a robe and a wig and a hat over his Snake Eyes costume.
So he's still wearing his mask.
He puts on like a coat. Yeah. It's like, who are you fooling? But apparently, and he's got his wolf too, which is just a thing that people walk around with. Transformers has a horrible one. It's something like the girl who fell in love with Power Glide or Power Glide's girlfriend or something. I can't remember. But it's a woman that's saved and she falls in love with the Transformer. And they try to date.
Interesting.
And it's a horrible episode. Yeah, it's awful. Maybe season three. It's one of those ones where you're like, all right, Transformers is kind of weird when it came over from Japan. So is this a Japanese thing? Did you write it before? I don't even know. But it's just awful. You see a lot of He-Man ones where you're like, this is just 5 minutes of art that you recycled throughout the episode. Mm-hmm. And stretched out to 30 minutes here somehow. I still enjoy it.
That's the thing. Like, you don't realize it as a kid. But, like, He-Man, like, every time he, you know, pulls out the sword and turns into He-Man, like, that's the same scene.
Same footage
in every episode. Sometimes it's in the episode multiple times. But it was a way for them to kill time without actually having to do new material.
Yeah, even him running, you could just reuse the cells of him running and put it over a new background.
Yep.
And save money. Yep. Like in a way, it's kind of genius to see the ways that they cut costs but still filled out a show. I'm like, well, you know, kind of well done there. But, you know, the animation shortcuts of there's nothing else happening right now except the mouths are moving.
Yeah.
And everything else is still. But when you're a kid, you didn't care and you loved it. And the crazy thing is when you see what could have been, like, the Thundercats opening is still one of the greatest pieces of animation ever. Mm-hmm. It's so beautifully drawn. It's so fast. It's so well timed and cut and everything. It's so good. And that is not the animation for the rest of the show, which was still a really well done show, but it's just not to the same level by any means. But it's funny because, you know, when you're a kid, you don't see it. When you were in your teens, early 20s, there's a nostalgia for it and a love. And then you actually sit down to do it again. You're like, oh, man, what is this? And I think the best way, because I've gotten my kid to watch a couple things here and there, you know, random episodes of things.
Yeah.
And he's just watching it like, whoa, I can't believe this happened. It's so cool. And, you know, there's fights and there's this and that and monsters and, you know, bad guys. And it's so cool. I'm like, okay, that's how I have to watch this.
Yeah.
I just need to turn off my brain and enjoy it for what it is.
Some of those 80s cartoons just ain't as good as you remember.
Ooh, some are tough.
I find is sometimes you remember like an episode or a plot line or something that didn't actually happen. It's like one of the Mandela effect things where you're like, I'm sure they did an episode where they did this, but then they didn't.
I've had them. G.I. Joe, I had ones. I'm like, I remember this. I remember this happening. I remember it being animated. You know, this, that, other thing. Mm-hmm. Now, some I've discovered are the when Marvel had the cartoon commercials for the comics.
Oh.
So there's when you feel like, oh, I remember this in my mind, and it wasn't an episode. It was a commercial.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, the same art and everything so well done. I turned it into a show. And then I found there's some where it's just, I confused the show. You know, I thought it was a Thundercats episode, it was a Silverhawks one, or, you know, there was enough cartoons that were similar along the way that I forgot what show it actually happened on.
Mandela Effect. Another episode that we did, if you're listening to this, dear listener, go back and listen to that. It was a good episode. All right, well, next on my list, I'm going to go with Image Comics. And I want to talk...
I was wondering if you're going to... if I should take it as a pick or not. But here we are.
And they're awful, awful business practices. And some awful comics. Now, what I mean is, right from the beginning, I mean, like, say what you will about DC and Marvel. you know, they are pretty good about getting, you know, their product out to their customers because that's their business. That's how they make money, right? Well, I guess now they make money off their movies, but I mean, for years, you know, when they were just a comic book company, you know, they needed to get their product out to their customers. So guaranteed, you know, from aside from a few, you know, gimmicks here and there, for the most part, Superman, you'll always find a Superman comic on the news, well, at the comic book store now, but back in the back in the day, you'd find it at the newsstand or you know, the spinner racks. You know, like, you know, X-Men came out every month. You know, all their top sellers, guaranteed, you would find them on the, you know, where you get your comics. but Image Comics, right from the beginning, when they started out, they were these hotshot artists like Jim Lee, Rob Liefeld, Todd McFarlane, Willis Bartaggio, Eric Larson, Valentino, I can't remember his first name, Mark Silvestri, yeah. Jim Valentino, yeah, Mark Silvestri. I don't know if I'm forgetting anybody. I apologize if I am. You know, they were these, you know, really up-and-coming hotshot, you know, artists that made their names for, you know, some of them started out at DC, but they were all pretty much ended up at Marvel in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, and you know, their books were selling. You know, Jim Lee helped relaunch the X-Men. Rob Liefeld launched X-Force. Todd McFarlane relaunched Spider-Man. And so, you know, Eric Larson was a Spider-Man guy, so on and so forth. These guys, you know, really were, you know, big hitters and revolutionizing, you know, the art form of comic books in the early 90s. And then they, you know, decided to go into business for themselves. And kudos to them for doing that. They created Image Comics, which is still around today. Image Comics is still a big player in the comic book industry. But right from the beginning, you know, they, delayed comic books, you know, like you would get these books, which back then there was this, debate, you know, what sells a good comic book at the end of the day? Is it the writing or is it the art? To be honest with you, for me, as a comic book reader, I will continue reading a comic book if the art's bad but the story's good. But I will always quit a comic book if the story's bad but the art's good. Because if I'm reading it and I'm not, you know, the story's not jiving with me, I'll abandon ship. But some people are the opposite. They're more about the art and not the story. Image, because they were, for the most part, all artists, they really believed that, you know, it was an artist's medium. And so they created, you know, they come up with these new characters, you know, Spawn, Wildcats, Youngblood, Shadowhawk, number of other titles. But they weren't the best written stories. Like, I've since went back and read some of these, like Spawn, for example. It, you know, I don't know. It's like what you were describing, Kev, about the cartoons, about how, you know, when you were a kid, they just seemed so much better. I remember Spawn, you know, when it first came out, being so awesome. But then actually going back and rereading it, it's like, ugh, this is rough. Like, I mean, the art looks amazing, but the story's not that good. You know, like it's really rough. Same with Wildcats, except for when Alan Moore came on. Like, when Alan Moore came on to do Wildcats, then it got really good. Like, it was awesome. I loved those years when Alan Moore was writing Wildcats. But other than that, like, all the other Wildcats, aside from, you know, the Jim Lee issues that looked really good, the stories weren't that good. Like, they just weren't. And then, they, you know, there was delays with Image Comics. Like, they would solicit these books for release, telling you, you know, say issue 4 of Wildcats is going to be coming out in May, and, you know, get ready, you know, for that issue. And then May would come and it wouldn't show up. And then you wouldn't get issue 4 until, like, say, August, you know, because for whatever reason, I guess Jim Lee was busy doing conventions or book signings or whatever, and just didn't get around to drawing the book. So there was all these delays that really pissed a lot of people off and turned them off to comics, you know, from Image anyway. But, you know, now all these years later, Image has become more of a comic book company, more of a creator-owned comic book company, where you're, you know, rather than getting, like, when Image first started, it was mostly, you know, they were doing the superhero thing, right? You know, they had all these different superhero characters, and they do still do. Like, I mean, Spawn is still coming out every month, all these years later. Savage Dragon is still coming out. But for the most part, like, now you got books like Black Science, you got The Walking Dead, which actually just ended last year. But, I mean, it was a zombie book. You know, you got these, you know, Jonathan Hickman books, like Red Mass and The Manhattan Projects. You got Saga, which is like a space... best way to describe it is like a space opera. Like it's awesome. Like, the art is amazing, the story's neat, they got a lot of interesting sci-fi concepts in there. Like I mentioned, Black Science, that is a really good science fiction comic book. I highly recommend that to anyone. So now that, you know, they've kind of branched out and people can kind of go to Image and do whatever they want, as far as comic books go. But unfortunately, some of their practices, you know, they don't hold the creators to their schedules, right? Or to a monthly schedule. They, like, creators can do whatever they want, pretty much, because they own their book. For example, Saga, I think, is still on hiatus right now. Like, they've been off for...
It still is, yeah.
Like, it's got to be 8 months since there's been a new issue. More, maybe? I'm not even sure. And that just... It's not a good business practice. You know, you want to keep people coming back, especially in comic books. When comic books are traditionally a monthly... you know, you get your monthly issue. You know, you don't want to take 6 months off. You don't want to take a year off. Like, I know Jonathan Hickman, I think there was a book called Sweet Tooth, or I might be thinking of a different comic book, where he started it and then he just stopped. Like, it's like he got bored and didn't want to do it anymore. And it just ended. And I don't understand, like, why would you do that? Like, begin a project and then just, I don't want to do it anymore. And then leave your readers hanging. Like, I just don't get that. But that being said, Image Comics has done some amazing things. Like I said, The Walking Dead. I mean, you know, it's one of the most famous television shows ever made now. And it started as an Image comic book. Honestly, one of my favorite comic books of all time is Invincible, which is also written by Robert Kirkman, who created The Walking Dead, and it was created by Robert Kirkman, and it's an amazing series. I love it. And then, yeah, some of the other titles I've mentioned, even Savage Dragon, like Eric Larson and Todd McFarlane, I'll give them credit, because they've stuck with their creations, and they continue to, for the most part, you know, they stuck to their schedules, and they put out their comics for their readers.
I don't know if you had the same experience I did, but I remember when Image started, and most of us learned from Wizard that it was coming, and everyone left. But a lot of us went down to our local comic shops and wrote all Image on our pull list. And for a while, that was fine. You had the 7 that left, and Wetworks was delayed immediately by like a year, I think, maybe longer.
Yep.
But then Rob Liefeld started trying to do Brigade and Bloodstrike and Young Bloodstrike found like just too much. Spawn started falling off schedule right away. Youngblood started falling off schedule right away. Jim Lee started, you know, messing around with other stuff. And I think what ended up being was, here's a bunch of young talent that couldn't focus, sort of like an ADHD way, and all of a sudden they're all millionaires. Mm-hmm. So of course they're not going to sit down and write and draw. Of course they're not. You know, Liefeld allegedly had a huge cocaine problem, along with most of Extreme Studios. Allegedly.
Well, and and that's the thing. Like we tend, looking back, you tend to forget that like these were just kids. Like the my son was their age. You know, like and yeah, like these guys became millionaires overnight. And they have all this money, so of course they're going to be partying. They're going to be, you know, buying expensive cars. They're going to be dating cheerleaders. You know, you name it, they're going to be doing it.
And no one watching over them.
Exactly, yep.
Yeah. But I think when it started, it was artist-driven. Obviously, those were the seven that left. And I think one of the... sorry, not Corona. I think one of the problems was... They knew they wanted to leave. They knew they wanted the money when they all left Marvel. And I get it. Hey, if you're going to have a poster, if you're going to have merchandise of my drawing of Spider-Man, my drawing of Wolverine, I should get a cut of my drawing. Mm-hmm. And they would say, no, we own Spider-Man. Yes, but I drew that version. I'm not asking for Kirby's money or Ditko's money. I'm asking for my money. And I think that's fair. Mm-hmm. But then when they left, it's like, okay, well, now what do I do? And I think Spawn and Savage Dragon being the big ones that succeeded is these were ideas that they already had. These were ideas that had a nostalgia factor within them. Like, Eric Larson chose drawings of Savage Dragon when he was a teenager. That was his baby.
Yep.
McFarlane has Spawn for a while. So I think that's why they continued, because they already had the love, much in the way that they probably loved Spider-Man and drew Spider-Man before they got hired for Marvel. They have that for these characters. Yep. Even though they were their own creations, they have a love, a nostalgia for them. But Youngblood, yeah, there's a couple of sketches you see, but there's no love in Youngblood. There's no love in Wildcats or Cyberforce. I think Shadowhawk is like right on the border. Because while it was being published, I think, you know, he cared, but we haven't seen anything Shadowhawk in decades now, practically. Yeah. What Works became a joke. And Will Spurtasky went through a lot of stuff, but, you know, he's the forgotten member of Image, really. Mm-hmm. Silvestri I don't think he cared about Cyberforce. I think he enjoyed drawing it. He liked that idea. I don't think he cared. I don't think he cared till he came up with Witchblade, which was much more successful and lasted much longer. Jim Lee, if he cared about the Wildcats and the whole Wildstorm universe that he created, we'd be seeing him in DC, which he now runs by himself.
Yep.
And there's nothing Wildstorm in DC. When they did the New 52, they brought in some for a little while. And then they all went away again. Like, if Liefeld sold all of Extreme Studios to Marvel just to come up with something, you know those characters would be popping up at least in the X-Men books all the time. Mm-hmm. If not more. But DC's done with Wildstorm what Marvel did with Ultraverse. It's just sitting on it. But then... Image itself, when they started going past artists, which then there was the second wave of we got all these other artists. You got Sam Keith for Max, you got Dale Keown for The Pit. You know, they tried it again to degrees of success. But then, yeah, they started waking up to no one cares about these books and no one cares about these characters because we haven't written a reason for them to care. I can look at pretty pictures all day, but if I don't have reason to care, then I'm just going to look at the pretty picture and throw it away. or forget about it. You know, I think one day we all realize it's like, okay, I've read Youngblood and Wildcats and a couple other of these books for the last year or two, and I can't tell you their names.
Mm-hmm.
There's something wrong here. But I knew the Spawn story. I knew the Savage Dragon story. I knew the ones that had some heart, you know, some passion to them. But like Cyberforce, I would really have to think to remember their names. Wetworks, forget about it. Not a chance in hell would I remember any of them. But then when they started, you know, like you said, they brought in Alan Moore for stuff. They brought in, you know, Spawn has three, Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, and Dave Sim, mm-hmm. writing three issues in a row, and it's like, oh, here's something we can do.
Yep.
Let's play with this idea. You know, then Alan Moore did, didn't he do a run on Supreme as well?
He did, yep.
You know, so when they started bringing people in, I'm like, okay, don't just come to us with pretty art, come to us with an idea. What's your book about? Who's writing it? Who's drawing it? What can you do? Then they became this phenomenal publisher that can do and publish anything. We got our superhero book, our space book, our zombie book, our romance book, our cartoon book, our this or that. And they all fit there as, you know, this independent publisher that's had hit after hit. And I mean, you needed those initial seven to walk so everyone else could run.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a reason, you know, Spawn and Savage Dragon are still going, because those two cared.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, like I said, with Wildcats, it did not get good till they actually brought in a good writer, and he actually fleshed it out, and actually, like you said, made you care about those characters, and you actually started remembering their names. Because you know Jim Lee, like maybe he's gotten better, but he's just for the writing aspect of it, he's not that good, or it wasn't back then anyway. So they really needed to bring in writers, and they did, and here we are, like Robert Kirkman, for example, like, that's all he is a writer, like, he's not an artist, but, yeah, like, I mean, The Walking Dead, like, he hit it out of the park, but,
Yeah, I mean, like, Stormwatch, I couldn't tell you anything from Stormwatch, but I know Warren Ellis had a good run on it, and transformed the whole idea.
Yep.
I think the last Wildstorm one that people really latched on to for a while was Gen 13, and then they kind of pissed that away.
Yeah. Well, because J. Scott Campbell at the time, like that, like he got his introduction, and he drew these, you know, beautiful looking characters, and that's really what sold the book for the longest time. And he kind of stepped back and then you realize there's really nothing to these characters. People didn't care anymore. But,
And I mean, that's, you know, like there's J. Scott Campbell covers today for Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, at least it's for Marvel. It's like, oh, okay, Black Cat's a cool character, a cool, interesting character. And J. Scott Campbell's doing a Black Cat cover. That at least makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get a good, you know, you get a good book out of it, as opposed to here's J. Scott Campbell for, you know, Girl with Powers, issue one. All right, I don't know what the heck that is.
Yeah.
Well, I actually, you know what happens when you do that? Then you have Jim Ballant, who did Catwoman for years and beautiful looking comics, and then out of nowhere decided, I want to do my own thing, and does this comic called Tarot, which is crazy ridiculous, but he gets to draw naked women, so he's happy, I guess.
Yeah. But, all right, well, let's move on to what's next on your list, Kevin.
Okay, so I'm going to go from cartoons of our youth to cartoons when we were adults, or specifically Adult Swim. Now, I don't know if it's called something different in Canada.
No, we have that up here.
It's dark. Okay. So Adult Swim, Cartoon Network, same channel, but because each version of the channel has X amount of original programming, they can count as two different channels. this is a trick that Nickelodeon used to do. Nickelodeon and Nick at Night were technically two different channels back in the day.
Okay, yeah.
So Adult Swim, a lot of it was, you know, your Family Guy repeats, Bob Burgers repeats, but they would have these little, like, 15-minute shows, mostly on the weekends, that you're watching, you're like, I'm not high, and I don't think I could enjoy the show unless I was, or understand it, or tolerate it.
Yeah.
But if you do enough in a row, you're like, oh, there's actually something here. So each individual episode looks completely stupid, a waste of time, who paid for this? But when you watch a few in a row and start understanding the humor and the writer and what they're going for, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, wait, they're actually doing something. They're actually building, and individually this all looks stupid, but put all together, it's actually very smart, and oh my gosh, what's happening to me? Because you can't believe that you're justifying it. But Tim and Eric is very strange and very odd. And when you watch one episode, you don't know what the hell's going on. But the more you do, the more you see a genius of it. Mm-hmm. The one that really got me is there's a terribly drawn, like, just cardboard cutout level drawing animation called 12 Ounce Mouse. It was on just one season, like 10, 12 episodes, something like that. And it's dumb, and it's terribly drawn, and I'm like, I don't understand, but for one random night, they had like four episodes on in a row or something. And all of a sudden, I realized, I'm like, oh my god, there's a story here. There's a long story going on. And it'd almost be like going into a back issue bins and picking up one issue of a comic in the middle of a storyline. You're like, I have no idea what this is. This is garbage. I don't understand it. But when you read the whole storyline, you're like, oh, this is great. Now I get what you're going for. And a lot of those were, they're awful individually, but the more you sit down for it, I mean, maybe it's a Stockholm syndrome, and you're just like, I'm here, I need to justify it, let me pretend it's something it isn't.
Yeah.
But I found myself enjoying them more and more when I could actually sit down and marathon them and see what they were going for.
Excellent.
I don't know if you've ever had the same experience with them. Probably not.
No, I honestly haven't watched much Adult Swim. But coming out of the Cartoon Network, I mean, Rick and Morty, I love Rick and Morty. And Adventure Time, I love Adventure Time. But as far as like the mini...
Steven.
Yeah, as far as the mini stuff, like I haven't really seen much of that, but...
Oh, and the funny thing is when my son was being born, we're at the hospital, my wife's like, just turn on something on the TV, just something so in between contractions I have something else to look at, watch, you know, just something to distract me. It's like, of course. So, I mean, we're flipping through, there's nothing on in the middle of the night. You know, there's infomercials and junk. So we landed on Adult Swim, and I think they're playing, you know, Family Guy or you know, Futurama or something when we're flipping through. She's like, yes, just stop, that's fine, that'll work.
Yep.
I don't really have to pay attention to it. I might get a laugh or two and distract myself. So very long labor. You know, we've watched a couple episodes of good stuff. Watched, you know, it's on.
Yep.
And out of nowhere, Squidbillies comes on. And my wife just screams and says, I will not have my child brought into the world with Squidbillies on the TV. Turn it to anything else. I don't care. Anything is better than this. I think we found the Golden Girls on at 4 in the morning or something like that.
Excellent. All right, yeah. Excellent choice there, Kev. All right, well, let's go one more time around the table. So for my last awful but good, this kind of, like, falls into what I was saying with Nerd Lunch and Buckaroo Banzai, the movie, where, you know, those guys really loved it and they really talked it up. But me having not seen it, I didn't enjoy it and thought it was really bad and I turned it off. But one movie that I saw when I was a little kid that I really loved that had a special place in my heart, but I actually know it's not very good, and that is Dolph Lundgren's 1987 Masters of the Universe film. The live-action He-Man movie.
There's so much there.
Yeah, like, I mean, in hindsight, reading up on some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, some of the obstacles that they had to deal with, you know, there's that awesome Power of Grayskull documentary on Netflix where they talked about a little bit. They did what they could with the limited budget that they had and the limited special effects that they, you know, were able to utilize because of budget reasons and because of, you know, it being 1987. So what was available to them at the time, they did the best they could, you know, budgetary reasons. You know, that's why one of the reasons why most of the movie takes place on Earth instead of Eternia, which, you know, is a big disappointment because, you know, you want to see, you know, some of the things you saw in the cartoon, but you don't get to see in this film. But, you know, they had to do that because they couldn't afford to do the epic that it should have been. You know, like this movie should have been done by, like, George Lucas and Lucasfilm, right? Like they needed something like that. But these guys just didn't have it. They didn't have the budget. They didn't have the resources. They did what they could with what they had to work with. That being said, you know, it's been a few years since I watched it. I think I watched it with my kids years ago when they were really little. And I think it was like a year or two ago, my wife and I were, you know, whatever, it was Friday night, Saturday night or whatever. We're like, I'm like, you know, let's watch, because I have it on DVD. I'm like, you know, let's watch He-Man. Okay. I think we got like 20 minutes into it. And then I looked at her, she looked at me, and it's like, I think I'm going to turn this off now. I think we're going to watch something else. And it has a special place in my heart. Like, I love Dolph Lundgren as He-Man. You know, when I think of live-action He-Man, you know, obviously he's the guy I think of. Like, he's like, you know, how Christopher Reeve is the ideal Superman in my mind. He's the ideal He-Man. You know, he did a great job. Frank Langella did amazing as Skeletor. Like, when you realize just how much he brought to that role. Like, amazing. And, you know, some of the character designs were really cool. But, you know, unfortunately, it was a victim of circumstance. You know, it was, you know, like, they did what they could do with what they had. You know, even the final battle between He-Man and Skeletor, you know, like, actually, when you look back at it, you know, it's really not that good. But, I mean, they literally had to film it in like one day, and they had to film it with basically no budget. Like, you know, like, that's why it's kind of like filmed in the dark with you know, smoke machines and lights to kind of take away from the fact that, you know, the action's not very good. It, you know, they had to choreograph it themselves. You know, they didn't have the benefit of you know, having, you know, professional stunt people, you know, but they did what they could with what they had, you know. And I mean, it gave us Courtney Cox, you know, like, this is pre Friends, you know, when she was, you know, a young and beautiful young woman before she was ever on Friends. It brought us Robert Duncan McNeil before Star Trek Voyager, before his, you know, episode of The Next Generation. I can't remember the actor's name, but it brought us Principal Strickland from Back to the Future as a cop. It brought us a Kirstie Alley lookalike as Evil Lynn. But, you know, it's got a special place in my heart. You know, it's awful, but it's good. And it's one of those, unfortunately, it had, you know, it was one of the first movies I ever remember having a post-credit scene where you get through all the credits. Because, Skeletor falls seemingly to his death, but we don't actually know. And then you see him pop out his head pop out of the water at the end of the credits, and he says, "I'll be back." And unfortunately, he never did come back. Much like Buckaroo Banzai, because apparently Buckaroo Banzai, they also have a plug for the next Buckaroo Banzai movie that never actually happened. But Kev, what are your thoughts on the Masters of the Universe movie?
I think it was like the first movie that, well, maybe even the first media I enjoyed that I had to justify to myself. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't the cartoon, it wasn't the toys, it wasn't the comic. It was its own thing that had some stuff to do with what I grew up watching and enjoying and wanting. And more so, what is this? Like, I don't understand why we need to create new bad guys when you have 20, 30 figures, you know, sitting in all of our bedrooms.
Yep.
That you could have put on screen just as easy. You know, you could take a force on Earth and call it a force in Eternia real quick. Like, there's just so much changed that mm-hmm. I didn't understand why it was even bothered to change. And yeah, it's canon films and it's this and that. And there, you know, there's all sorts of stuff now. But I was just like, okay, it's not bad. It's not bad. It's okay. I can, yeah, sure, I can. Well, that's a good decision. You know, like, just trying to give any reason mm-hmm. to accept it because you just wanted that He-Man movie so bad. And it's not what it was. I can enjoy it now for it's a different take. It's a different interpretation. It's a product of its time. But I know I was lying to myself as a kid that I wasn't deeply disappointed by it. I think the only redeeming moment was when they finally did some Masters of the Universe figures of characters created for the movie. And mm-hmm. then they seemed more legitimate, I guess. Gwildor had a figure with a blade, I think is his original name.
Yep.
Not that there, you know, was a lack of original names in Masters of the Universe, but still.
Yeah.
It made me feel a little better by it. Like, I can still picture some of those toys at KB. And I was like, okay, now you're a real Masters of the Universe figure, not from this strange Earth 2 version in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember as a kid wanting Orko to show up so bad. You know, I don't know why, but I just wanted Orko to be there. I wanted him to turn into Prince Adam. That never happened. King Randor, no. Queen yeah. Marlena, I wanted to see them. You know, especially when they went to Earth, you know, because He-Man's half-human, because his mom comes from Earth. She was a NASA astronaut that got crash-landed on Eternia somehow. But, if, you know... But He-Man seemed to know nothing about Earth, and his mom wasn't in the movie. So, yeah, there's so many things that they should have done better. But, unfortunately, it is what it is. But I can't help but think that maybe the screenwriters didn't actually know a lot about He-Man. They didn't actually watch the cartoons. But that
well,
being...
that's the canon style, though. Did you ever see the documentary? Oh my gosh, I can't believe I can't. Electric Boogaloo, Story of Canon Films.
No, I haven't seen that. No.
Okay. They did a giant set, which my wife was nice enough to buy me when it came out. It's a documentary, and then 10 of their films.
Oh, okay.
Which is fantastic. But the documentary itself has got to be available on streaming. They would get their art team together. Hey, make up posters for movies. And it would be, you know, they draw someone with guns or, you know, a girl with guns and her boobs hanging out and monsters and aliens and, you know, car chases and all sorts of stuff and come up with crazy names for it. And they would put all of them in a room and they'd bring in your foreign distributors and say, hey, here's the movies we have coming out. Which ones would you like? And they're like, oh, I'll give you $1 million for this movie and $2 million for that and $3 million for that. They say, okay, thank you very much. And then they'd pull those posters and say, okay, go write the movie and make it. And that's how they decided what movies they would actually make. The nice. Ones that people have now given them money to make. So I think, like, it wouldn't shock me if they're like, oh, He-Man's cool, sure, let's just do a poster and put He-Man on it and, you know, cross our fingers.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's a shame because, you know, like, He-Man, like we were talking about J. Michael Straczynski, like, I mean, that would have been the perfect writer to write this movie if had they utilized him. But, like I said, they were...
Oh, yeah, and I'm very curious about the Kevin Smith one coming up in the next year.
Yeah, like the cartoon and then...
the animated one.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Maybe a live-action film at some point. Like, I know they keep talking about it, but... But anyway, Kev, last on your list, sir.
Okay, it's a broad thing. It's not a specific one. But it's going to fit in with a thing I thought was awful at the time that now I think was good. And that's going to be our childhood lack of options for TV.
Okay.
When maybe if you're lucky you have a TV in your bedroom. If not, you have to sit down and watch whatever mom's watching or dad's watching or your grandparents watching or your siblings watching and you're forced to share the TV.
Yep.
I would say like 2 through 20 was the channels when I was growing up. 2 through 13 was like network, quote unquote. And then you might have a couple cable. And I think we expanded to like 60 channels and then 100 channels. And that was it for a long, well, 99, because the box couldn't do more than a 99.
Yep.
But that was it for a long time. And I think that a lot of stuff we, our generation discovered was because of things like that, because we weren't, you know, flipping, you know, going through Netflix and YouTube and all the options and infinite amounts of DVDs and everything else. Like, it was, here's your choices. Here's what's on right now. No DVR, no TiVo. Pick something. If you want to watch something, it's whatever's on right now.
Yeah.
Or it's whatever someone else in your family is already watching. And you've got to watch it too. But I think a lot of the stuff that we discovered and have a certain nostalgia for is only because of this, which kids today are not going to get because they got their own screens. They got, you know, a million options. There's no good reason we as teenage boys should have been watching the Golden Girls. There really isn't. But chances are someone in our family was, or we watched like, you know, something that was on earlier that night and just didn't bother changing the channel. And now we have this love and affinity for four old retired women being snarky and sarcastic with each other. There's no, if that show was on today, I apologize.
No problem.
I swear it's not Corona. But if that show was on today, not a chance in hell would your teenage boy demographic find it. You know, all of the, it's Saturday night at the movies on, you know, whatever channel they're playing some random movie. You're like, I don't know, that looks good. Looks good enough to watch tonight. So you'd put it on. Or, I mean, a lot of us have a soap opera that we remember a good couple years of because that's what whoever was watching us after school would be watching. So you're sitting in the same room doing your homework and they got, you know, whatever soap opera on, you're like, all right, I guess I know what's going on here.
Yep.
The Young and Restless, General Hospital, whatever it might be. And yeah, when we were kids, it was like, well, I want to watch my cartoon. I want to watch my movie. I want to watch this. I want to watch that. And either it wasn't on or someone else had the TV and it wasn't an option to change it. So you're just like, fine, I guess I'm watching this. And that's not, it's never going to happen again. Like, there's some stuff, you know, my kid's like, I don't want to watch this. It looks boring. It looks dumb. I don't want to. Okay, well, I do. But he knows he can just say, well, I don't want to, and pick up an iPad and go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Like, that wasn't, you know, if we went somewhere else, it was to play, you know, with our toys, read a book, something like that. We weren't going somewhere else to watch another show. And in a way, I kind of missed that. Like, I think there was a lot of stuff discovered that way that won't be discovered now. Or you'd almost have to force them to watch it now.
Yeah, I agree. And not just that, but like appointment TV. You know, like there's a few shows that are still out there that you know, they come on, you know, at a certain time, but generally you can pick it up with streaming or whatever on your DVR or whatever and watch it at your convenience, right? But back when we were kids, you know, like, say, Star Trek The Next Generation, if I wasn't home Friday night at 7 o'clock to watch the new episode, I didn't get to watch it for months. You know, I had to be home to watch it. And that's just not a thing anymore, you know? But it made you appreciate it at the time, right? Like, you had to make that commitment. You had to make sure that you were at home. You know, you had to change your schedule. I remember one Christmas being at my uncle and auntie's, and like I had to get my mom to drive me home because it was Christmas Day and Chain of Command Part 2, Next Generation Season 6. It was airing Christmas Day locally. And I know, like, if I didn't watch it then, I wasn't going to probably get a chance to watch it for who knows how long until they reran it, which probably wasn't going to be until springtime, you know? So I'm like, nope, Christmas is over. I got to go home. You got to drop me off, you know, like I got to watch it. But kids nowadays, like, that's just not a thing, you know, like if you don't catch the new episode of Westworld on Sunday night, it's going to air again in like 3 hours on the same channel. Or you can watch, or you can stream it, you know, on you know, the HBO app, or up in Canada, it's the Crave TV app. But, you know, I, in a way, you know, it's a blessing that we have the things we have, you know, like, for example, like we were talking about, you know, the Transformers, G.I. Joe, like I know they're on the Tubi app right now, the original ones that we used to watch when we were kids, and... You know, I now that I'm stuck at home, I've been thinking about maybe catching up on a few episodes because I haven't watched those in years, you know, just to check them out. So it's nice that we have those options, you know, like, but at the same time, you know, I think we've lost something, you know, like, for example, the Saturday morning cartoon ritual. That's not a thing that kids...
Oh, completely gone. Yeah, that kills me.
Yeah, and kids will never understand, you know, the point of like, I remember when I was, like, a really little guy, Masters of the Universe, the cartoon, aired 7 a.m. on Saturday morning. So, like, you know, that's the day where you don't have to go to school, when you should be sleeping in, but I didn't. I got up every Saturday so I can watch He-Man at 7 in the morning because that's when it aired. And if I didn't watch it then, I wasn't watching it. But now
I remember getting the TV guide and circling my TV watching, like, okay, what shows are on at 9? Okay, I want to watch those ones Saturday morning at 9. Okay, what's on at 9:30? All right, well, I got to pick. I can only watch one, so which one am I going to watch?
Well,
and like planning out the day.
Yeah, and I think we talked about it not too long ago in a previous episode, but TV guide. I miss TV guide. You know, I loved having those. You know, in the last few years, like I don't know, TV Guide doesn't exist where you're at, right?
It still does as an oversized magazine.
Oh, okay.
And it's quick articles, you know, some fashion and interview, and then it's a broad thing like, you know, the Fox. 8 on Monday will air this, 9 this, and 10 this, and that's it. You know, they'll just show, they won't show like, okay, your local channel will play, you know, Family Feud at this time and Jeopardy at this time. They don't go into detail like that when they used to have, you know, the individual listings for each market. It's just like across the nation, here's what's on, you know, USA and TBS and Sci-Fi Channel, okay. And that's it.
See, yeah, we don't even get that. Like, we get nothing anymore. And actually, I rewatched an episode of Seinfeld, like, I don't know, like a month or two ago. Like, the one where Elaine takes George's dad's TV guide from their house.
Yeah, but he has the collection.
And, yeah, he collects them. And he has little boxes that he puts them in. It's like, man, I miss TV Guide. I remember TV Guide. You know, the last few years that it existed in our market, I actually subscribed to it because, like, I had cable at the time, so I was able to utilize it. But then I switched to satellite, and I didn't need it anymore, and then it just disappeared. Like, they stopped making them. But, yeah. The good old days. But
I mean, if I saw TV Guide at a yard sale or something right now, I think I'd have to get it just to see the old ads, the old listings, the nostalgia, you know, shows I forgot about.
I actually have I'm picking it up right now. The only somewhat TV Guide thing I have, it's a TV Guide, the collector's edition, Farewell to Star Trek: The Next Generation. So it's like this mini book, but it's made in the same size as a TV Guide, and they released it.
Oh, cool!
Yeah, they released it when TNG went off the air in '94, and somehow I lost them. Like I bought two of them, I lost them, and then I picked this one up at a convention like a few years ago, and yeah, it's awesome. I love it. But that's the only TV Guide related item I have in my collection. So, but anyway, all right, Kev, well, let's move on to our next segment, which we call Brain Candy. Now, for our Brain Candy segment, we talk about one thing, maybe another thing, that we've been watching or reading. So we each take a turn at this. So Kevin, why don't you kick it off? What have you been watching or reading lately?
I have been going through a ton of graphic novels lately. I'm at home. Mm-hmm. I had a bunch that I took up from the library right before everything shut down, and now all the libraries say, just if you have anything, hang on to it. We're not doing late fees right now until we're reopened. Going through my own collection of stuff I haven't read. If I'm reading lots of good stuff, the problem is I only have like volume one of a lot of good stuff because I only took out the one to see if I would enjoy it. But I just read Man Thing, written by R.L. Stein, which I didn't even know he did.
Hmm.
It's apparently the first time he's done a comic for, you know, someone else's property.
Yeah,
loads of fun. Reads like a Goosebumps, you know, kind of over top, silly, you know, your teen, junior high humor and mentality, but with Man Thing. So absolutely ridiculous, but that was loads of fun. let me think what else. I read, are you familiar with Zine Scope comics?
Yes. I'm trying to think of something that they've... I bought a graphic novel from them at a convention, because I think they were at a convention I went to. But go ahead.
Yep. They very pretty girl drawn covers.
Yes.
And they're usually based on some sort of fairy tale or a legend that's also public domain, and this is just their twist on them.
Yes. I think I bought a Cinderella one or something, I think, where she's like a secret agent.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's absurd. They take these characters, and it's still true to the original legend, but in this modern take that you're like, all right, I can't believe you went from here to here and successfully, but somehow you did. So I actually have Belle, which is a Beauty and the Beast takeoff. Okay. And it's like Belle and Batman, really, is the best shorthand I could give. And with Zine Scope, to go back to our Image Comics discussion,
mm-hmm.
the art on the cover is never going to match the interior art. They'll always get whoever's, you know, beautiful painted drawing, whatever, you know, posters for the cover. But the inside's still pretty good. But what they've done, because I reviewed some stuff from them years ago, I'm like, this is awful. Beautiful cover, terrible. The art's bad, the writing's bad, all of it. they've upped the game for both of those. So it's no, it's not going to match the cover, but it's not that as much of a step off as it used to be.
Okay.
So this Bell book, I'm like, it's actually written well. There's twists and turns. There's action. There's some mystery. It's drawn pretty well, too. If the cover is a 10, the drawing's like a 7 or an 8. It's still pretty good. You know, whereas before, I'm like, this is like a 3 if the cover's a 10. But I enjoyed the heck out of it. I'm like, this is, it's dumb fun, too. It's totally like, I'm trying to think of, is there any chance you got like USA Up All Night stuff? Your late night B movie kind of cheesecake.
Okay, yeah.
Girls and Monsters stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, it's like that. But I'm like, this is just fun. It was entertaining. It was actually well written. It was well drawn. No, it's not going to be like, you know, Alan Moore or Alex Ross or Mark Waid or, you know, anything. Mm-hmm. But it was still good and fun. You know, it's not going to win, you know, it's not going to win awards, but I enjoyed the heck out of myself, and I don't feel like I wasted time or money. So I think I'm going to try to find some more of that, which sadly, the joy of it is people buy it right away for the covers, and then they sit in back issue bins. So it's kind of sad, because it's like once the people come through to just want the cover and, I don't know, slab it or get someone to sign it or whatever, they sit there. So I think I could probably pick up a bunch for cheap, and I'm actually looking forward to it.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, for my brain candy, I'm talking about a TV series called Hunters.
I've been curious.
Yeah, season one just dropped like a month ago on Amazon Prime. I gotta say, I liked it. I really liked it. I'm giving it a solid 4.5 out of 5.
Really?
Yeah, I really, really like this show. Al Pacino, fantastic. Awesome. That being said, the only nitpick I have is sometimes it feels too much like Inglourious Basterds. For those who don't know, like, the premise of this series, it takes place in the 70s, and it's about a group of, they're not all Jewish people, but Al Pacino plays a Jewish person that was in a concentration camp, and he leads a group of Nazi hunters, and they're going after people that basically escaped justice following World War II. These are the Nazis that, you know, were brought in by the U.S. government to work at NASA and different things like that. My only nitpick is sometimes it's too much like Inglourious Basterds, and certain eccentric scenes at times kind of takes me out of the story a little bit. But that's minor. Overall, it was really good, really good series. And I'm not going to reveal anything. I'm not going to spoil anything. But the first season finale had two plot twists that the first one literally shook me. Like, I cannot believe what they did. To me, it's right up there with The Sixth Sense, where you find out Bruce Willis was dead the whole time. It's like that type of twist. I didn't see it coming. You know, and then, like, kind of like The Sixth Sense, where, you know, when he realizes he's dead, you know, they do the flashbacks from previous scenes in the movie where the hints were there, but you didn't pick up on them. And you're like, holy shit, like, the hints were there all along, and I totally missed it. Similar thing with this. I'm not going to say what it is, but it shook me. It literally, my jaw dropped when this happened. And it was good. It was so good. The second twist, I didn't know it was coming. But as soon as they started setting up the scene, I knew exactly where they were going, because it plays into a Nazi conspiracy theory, and they executed it beautifully. Like, it was such a neat way to end the first season. I don't know, like, as far as I know, it hasn't been renewed for a second season, but I can't imagine it wouldn't be. It is that good. I really liked it. The only thing that I think might hold it back is I imagine this show probably costs a lot to make, because it takes place in the 70s, primarily in New York City. So I know, like, you know, shows like Mad Men and Boardwalk Empire, when they have to recreate, you know, different time periods, I know it's very expensive to do, you know, because, you know, you got to change the look of the streets, you got to have the right cars, you got to have the right clothes, hairstyles, you got to have the right things on TV, you know, like that sort of thing. I know it's very expensive to do those type of shows, but this one was done very well. It really puts you, gives you the 70s feel. And like I said, it's well worth it. Well worth it. And then I just wanted to quickly throw this out there. On YouTube, there's a guy who does videos, review videos. He's called The Critical Drinker. So basically his shtick is, he reviews things while drunk, or he says he's drunk. But he slurs his words, and he's funny. He does reviews like on Marvel movies and on TV shows, and it's funny, and he somehow always relates it to drinking and getting drunk, and he always has, you know, funny anecdotes in that regard. But his reviews are always spot on. Like, everything he calls out is accurate. Honestly, out of all the videos I've watched of his, there, I have yet to find one where I disagreed with him. Like, he nails everything on the right on the head. So yeah, he's The Critical Drinker, and he's on YouTube. But all right, well, let's move on to our final segment of the evening, and that is our Enders segment. Kevin, do you have anything you wanted to bring up in Enders before I start on my
Picard? No, rant? And actually, that's the thing. They just announced that due to, you know, everything in the world right now, there's a 30-day free trial of CBS right now, and all of Picard is included. So I went to sign up, and it wanted a little more information than that. It was pretty much like, I'm not sure I'm signing up in a way that I won't be charged in 30 days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I want to try it again and see how much of it I can get through here. But well, I'm going to try.
Yeah.
I just don't want to be charged in 30 days.
Yeah. I hear you. Well, before I talk about, like we are doing, our next episode is going to be our review of Star Trek Picard, or I should say my review. I'm hoping Kevin will join, even though I know, Kev, you haven't watched all the episodes. You know, you understand Star Trek, and you understand the characters. So, I don't really think you need to have watched it in order for me to talk to you about it. And I might have someone else coming on as well, a guy that actually I met at a Star Trek convention. His name is also Richard, not to be confused with Richard Reeder. He's a different Richard, and he's a big Star Trek fan. And from what I've been reading on Facebook, I don't think he's really liking Star Trek Picard. So I invited him on the show so he can give his perspective. So it's not just me, you know, crapping on everyone's parade. But so we'll see. Hopefully Richard will be on. But before I get into talking about Star Trek Picard, episode 9, because we are doing that episode, but I have been reviewing each individual episode or episodes as they've come out, so I'll give my thoughts on episode 9. But apparently, there's a rumor floating around that there's going to be a new Star Trek series, which is going to follow the adventures of Captain Pike, with Anson Mount returning as that character. I don't know if this is actually confirmed. You know, like, I know there's a lot of speculation. I'd be okay with it. You know, I love Anson Mount. He's one of my favorite actors. Just yesterday, he liked one of my comments on one of his posts, which I thought was pretty cool. You know, he was definitely the highlight of season 2 of Discovery. Like, having him as Captain Pike was amazing. He was really good. Hell on Wheels, one of my favorite TV shows. Probably my favorite TV Western, for sure. He was Colin Bohannon on that show. I'd be okay with a Captain Pike series as long as they go back to the original formula. You know, like, go back to exploring strange new worlds, to boldly go where no man has gone before. That's what I want with my Star Trek.
You don't want a Discovery spinoff that's just like Discovery.
Exactly. One Discovery is enough. You know, I want to see Captain Pike and the Enterprise on their mission of exploration. I don't want to see them murdering people. I don't want to see time crystals. I don't want to, you know, I just want to go back to the way Star Trek used to be. And I think Anson Mount would do excellent. You know, and Gregory Peck's grandson there, you know, as Spock, I think, you know, he might be okay. Rebecca Romijn is number one. I think she'll be okay. But, yeah, I just really hope they don't do the Discovery format. You know, I want them to be more like the original series, especially if they're on the Enterprise. Kev, what are your thoughts on a Captain Pike Star Trek show?
I think, and one of your complaints for Discovery was it's not fitting in where they say it's supposed to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
But I think with Pike, even if it is a spinoff quote of Discovery, you got more of a connection to what came before that you might be able to sort of right the ship in a way. And it can be, you know, current technology for special effects and filming and everything, but look truer to, you know, fitting into Star Trek, it prequel in a way, but not, but yes. But all that you've said for Discovery, and I've, you know, like, I'll talk to my wife, you know, usually the next morning about what we talked about. And she'll say, even I know that's not Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what it should be. So I think Pike might be a way to sort of reset it. And, you know, you could, I don't know if Discovery's going to third or not, but if they want to continue with this with the actor, you could, you know, learn from the lessons of Discovery and continue on a better path there. And maybe he'll be the good thing that comes out of the negative that you and most Star Trek fans feel for Discovery.
Yeah, well, I'm hopeful, but honestly, I don't think that's going to happen. Like, Discovery is coming back for a third season, and it's going to be separate from the Pike show. But this is a show that's still being made by the same people that make Discovery, that still make Picard, and, you know, I'm just hoping that someone is listening to the fans and they just go back to the way, you know, like, Star Trek really has become lazy writing. Like, you know, like, it back in the day, you would do a Star Trek episode, you had a beginning, middle, and end. Each episode told its own story. Unless it was a two-part episode, then it was, you know, you told the story over two hours. But, you know, you moved on. Like, you know, the story ended. I mean, things, you know, the characters might change a little bit. for the next story, but, you know, you've told your story. Whereas Discovery and Picard, they just kind of drag out this story, like, and they're not even doing that good of a job of it. Like, the showrunner of Picard said that this is basically a 10-hour movie or a 10-hour episode, but it's not, because there's so much bad
filler.
filler, and things aren't getting resolved. Things are getting forgotten. You know, my big issue with Discovery and with the Kurtzman Star Trek universe that they're making is they're ignoring continuity, right? But another problem I'm noticing, especially in Picard, is they're forgetting their own continuity. They're forgetting things that they did in their own episodes. And they can't even keep their own track of their own continuity. I'm just hoping with the Captain Pike thing that, you know, it'll be the best of a bad situation, and maybe, you know, Anson Mount and them and whoever's working on it might be able to do some good with what they have to work with, but I don't know.
So not getting your hopes up though.
No, I'm definitely not. which leads me into Star Trek Picard, episode 9. And you were there, Kev, like when before this show ever started, you heard me say that, you know, I was hopeful, you know, fingers crossed, Patrick Stewart's involved. I don't think he would get involved unless it was going to be good.
You're putting more faith in Patrick Stewart than you were for the showrunners.
Yes. And I think I may have got that wrong. Because I think the reason he came back is I think they paid him a lot of money. I really think that's what's happening here. So with episode 9, you know, just going over. Okay, so I'll throw out the basic premise of what happened is they on the La Serena, I think that's the name of the ship. And that's the thing, like, a lot of these characters, a lot of these ships, I don't even know the names of, because they're not that interesting. I just don't care. Captain Rios' ship is going through this Borg conduit to go to the android homeworld, and they get there, and then the evil Romulan guy's trying to kill them, and then he gets disabled, and then for some reason, 7 of 9 and the Borg cube, you know, the one that the Romulans were working on, somehow it shows up. There, it comes through a warp conduit, and then some space flowers come up from the surface, some giant space flowers, and kind of like a Venus flytrap, they grab onto each of the ships, and they knock out the ship's powers, and then they all crash land on the planet. And I'm not making this up. This did happen on this episode. Space flowers. So they crash land on this planet, because these space flowers, somehow these space flowers come up through the atmosphere of the planet. They don't burn up coming up through the atmosphere, but when they
freeze going out.
Yeah. But when they Venus flytrap the ships and pull them down into the planet, they burn up. So I don't understand the science. It really confused me. So anyway, they crash land on this planet. Somehow everyone's okay. Even though they crash landed on a planet, everyone's fine. The ships are good. So they go to the android colony. Oh, and I should point out, one of the things that drives me nuts about Star Trek Picard is, like, we knew that Jeri Ryan was going to show up on the show as 7 of 9. Like, that they didn't hide that. She was in the trailer. And you knew Brent Spiner was going to show up. They didn't hide that. He was in the trailer. But on the episodes when they do show up, they list them in the opening credits. So when they do show up...
Oh, no.
Yeah, so when they do show up,
it's supposed to be a surprise.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like, holy shit, they're 7 of 9.
Yeah.
But the first episode she was on...
Hate it when shows do that.
Yeah, she was in the opening credits, and then she showed up literally in the last 10 seconds of that episode. And I'm like, holy shit, where the fuck was she for this whole episode? You listed her in the opening credits, and she shows up 10 seconds.
Yeah, no, you do a little... Nope, you do a tag at the end, and Jerry Ryan. And,
yes.
You know, whatever actor is the surprise. Yeah, you don't do it in the opening.
So anyway, we were led to believe that Brent Spiner was coming back for the first episode when you see him as Data in Picard's visions, right? So this episode starts up, and you see Brent Spiner listed in the credits, opening credits. So I was like, oh... Okay, I guess Data or somebody's showing up, or Picard's going to have a dream or something. I don't know. So, yeah, he does show up, but he shows up as Dr. Soon, who was Data's creator. He shows up as Dr. Soon's biological son. Dr. I don't know, Anton Soon or Ajax or Asterix or something. I don't know. So, again, this drives me nuts with the Kurtzman Star Trek. You know, kind of like how Michael Burnham, you know, like, oh, guess what? Spock had this foster sister that grew up with him. She was human, and he never mentions her, ever. But she was there. You know, they ask you to believe that, okay? So now this... new Dr. Soon, you know, which is basically Brent Spiner without makeup. It's just him as he is, as he looks now. So where did this guy come from? He was never mentioned ever before. Dr. Soon never said he had a son. His wife never said they had a son. Data
that he based his greatest creation on looking exactly like.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd think it would have come up.
Yeah. You know, I'm hoping that somehow in the season finale they're going to explain that, because I mean they don't actually Google search this guy, they just take him for his word that he, oh yeah, I'm Dr. Soon's son, oh yeah, you know, I'm like Data's human brother. You kind of just take it, they're taking it from his word. They didn't actually do a Google search on him, so I'm kind of hoping that maybe this is actually lore. Like, somehow he's transferred his mind into a human body. Because, you know, like, when you go to this android colony, some of the androids look like Data. They got the gold skin, the yellow eyes, and, you know, and they look very much like Data. But then there's human-looking androids that look like, you know, the humanoid Cylons from Battlestar Galactica. Like, they look like humans. You can't tell that they're androids, except for, you know, the way they tilt their head and their mannerisms and stuff. And the fact that, you know, like Soji and Dodge, they can, like, leap tall buildings in a single bound. You know, they could bend steel and, you know, basically they're like super girls. So I'm kind of hoping that maybe this is actually lore, that he somehow transferred himself into a humanoid android body. Maybe, because, like, I just find it so weird, like, this whole show, like, Data had two brothers that were in established continuity. There was B4, which is apparently the prototype that Dr. Soon originally created, then he created Lore, and then he created Data. But Lore has not been mentioned at all in Star Trek Picard, just B4 and Data. So I'm hoping maybe, you know, the writers are actually doing something cool, and that, you know, maybe this
purposely not mentioning him so you don't suspect it.
Yeah, because this guy acts a lot like Lore, like the way he talks, and some of the things he said. You know, like, I know there's a YouTube video out there where the YouTuber predicts that this is Lore, because some of the things he says are Lore-ish. So I'm kind of hopeful, like, fingers crossed, maybe the writers are actually going to pull off something really cool here. But I'm so afraid that they're not. You know, like, they've disappointed me so much that I might be disappointed again.
Your trust is waning.
Yes, yes. So, again, what's with new Trek introducing new siblings to establish characters that we'd never heard of before? So there's that, giant flowers in space. What the fuck is that? And then, yeah. Like this,
I gotta look that up.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible. And this episode, they bring 7 of 9 into it, like, in a badass way. Like, she literally brings the Borg cube to this planet for some reason, because in the previous episode, she was hooked up to the Borg cube, and she kind of became the queen of that cube temporarily. And apparently when she was hooked up to the cube, she could see that Picard was gonna fly into danger or something, so she decided to bring the cube there to help him. So she crash lands, they crash land on this planet, she shows up for literally like a minute of screen time, and that's it. She plays no significant part in this series at all. She had one episode where she showed up and she was, you know, she was working with the La Serena crew and working with Picard, but the whole time she was lying to Picard, and she kind of, you know, stabbed him in the back a little bit and whatever, you know, she gets a pass, I guess. But other than that, like, she's, like, having her back seems almost pointless. It almost seems to me like with this show, what's happening is, and I've heard that one of the reasons why the release was delayed, because, I mean, this show came out a year and a half after it was announced. One of the reasons for the delay, from what I heard, is they had to go back and do some rewrites and reshoot some stuff and all that kind of thing. And it kind of feels like that, because sometimes certain scenes just seem out of place. Like, where did this come from? Like, they had one scene in this episode where Raffi is telling Picard that she loves him. And I know it's not meant to romantically, like, she's saying she loves him because he's a friend, right? He's a mentor.
Yeah.
And I know that's what they were going for. She doesn't have romantic feelings, like, I get that. But it just seemed out of nowhere. It's like, all, you know, she's thanking him. Like, the whole series, she spends shitting on Picard. You know, like, she's mad at him for ruining her career. She's mad at him for dragging her out into space. She's mad when her son won't forgive her for, what, you know, being a drunk or whatever on that one episode where they're in Space Vegas. And then now all of a sudden she's thanking him and telling him that she loves him. Like, it was weird. It was, I really think they filmed that at a later date and just inserted it into the episode. This episode did have a very original series feel to it. Like, the costumes that the androids were wearing were very simplistic, very similar to the original series. The location that they filmed, the way it was dressed, had a very original series vibe to it, which was a positive, I'll give it that. Like, it was kind of nice. But yeah, like I said, it seems like they've forgotten the writers have forgotten their own continuity. So the whole series is, you know, the Romulans are looking for these androids because they want to destroy them, because there's the secret organization of strong Romulan females called the Vatosh, or I don't know. It's called something. And, you know, basically they're like high ranking Tal Shiar chicks, because apparently there's no guys in this organization. It's all female, but whatever. Okay. I'll go with that. But their mission is to make sure that, sentient artificial life is not allowed to exist. Commodore O, who is the head of Starfleet security, who people believed was a Vulcan, is actually a half Vulcan, half Romulan officer. And she's infiltrated Starfleet for the sole purpose. Apparently, she infiltrated Starfleet when they found when this group found out about Data, and that Data was part of Starfleet. So she was sent in to work her way up through the ranks to basically get close to Data, and maybe presumably kill him at some point. But he
so long, Khan.
Yeah, the long con is what she was going for. But he died anyway, so it didn't matter for her. And then they had that those androids turn against everyone at the Utopia Planitia shipyards, and they destroyed the shipyards. They destroyed a lot of the Mars colonies. And then the Federation outlawed the making of androids. And that was all her. She was behind that whole conspiracy, right? So you're led to believe that these Romulans are wrong, that they're, you know, Data was a good android, so, and Dodge and Soji, they seem to be good, and, you know, the Romulans are wrong. They're bad people. But in this episode, they flip it around, and now it's the androids that are bad, and they actually do want to kill everybody. So the whole time, the Romulans were right? Like, we went 9 episodes believing that they were the bad guys, and they are doing terrible things, but it might actually turn out that they were right all along? Like, I don't know what these writers are going for here. Like, it just blows my mind.
It's a long way into your season to do a 180.
It is. It absolutely... It's like... Going to watch a James Bond movie and then finding out that James Bond was the bad guy all along. Like, yeah. It makes no sense. But, and then, like I said, they're forgetting their own continuity. Like, the Dr. Girardi there, Agnes Girardi, who killed Bruce Maddox in the Vegas episode, she did whatever, suffocated him to death or whatever. And it's like the whole crew forgets about it. Like, she gets a pass. She's hanging out with them, joking around with them. And it's like, guys, why is this nut job not locked up? She murdered somebody. And yet they're patting her on the back and giving her hugs. And it's like, what? You know, this person literally murdered a human being. And you're trusting her. And the writers didn't even write it in a way that she could get away with it. Like, in you know, have it be justified. Like, because what had happened was Commodore O gave her a mind meld. And she saw what, you know, the vision that she was given that, you know, all androids are going to destroy, you know, organic life. So that's why she killed Bruce Maddox. Because of this vision that O showed her. But the writers could have written it that O planted a command into her during the mind melt, saying that when you see Bruce Maddox, you have to kill him. Then she would have been free and clear, right? She would have been like, well, I didn't want to kill him, but the mind melt made me do it. And then it'd be kind of justified. You could accept it, be like, okay, she had no control, you know, like she was brainwashed, essentially, into committing this crime. You know, let's forgive her, let's bring her back into the group, you know, let's, you know, give her a hug, and you know, she can work with us again. But none of that, it wasn't written that way. She chose to kill somebody, and they're okay with it, I guess? Like, it's not a big deal, all of a sudden? And then there's this forced, you know, relationship between her and Captain Rios. You know, like they had like a one-night stand, and now it seems like they're in love somehow, even though they never really laid any groundwork to establish a romantic connection.
Well, it seems like they're writing a scene and just putting people in there, but not actually writing a character.
Exactly.
And, you know,
yes.
Yeah, oh, I want this scene to happen. I want to get from point A to point B, and then we just throw people in here. Okay, but that's not the character. That doesn't work for this character. So either rewrite the scene or put someone else in here that it would work for.
Well, it's almost like, because there's so many, like, I think this show has like 8 or 9 executive producers. And that's not even including, like, any other producers, like supervising producers, line producers, whatever. These are all executive producers. It's almost like everyone writes a part of a script and they all just, you know, everyone puts the pages together and they just go with it. You know, like they don't actually, like, sit in a writer's room and actually break down how the episode progresses.
Yeah. Do the whiteboard and all the little note cards.
Yeah. Like, on the Deep Space Nine documentary, they broke down what would be the first... Like, if they were to do a season 8 of Deep Space Nine, they broke down what the first episode would entail. And, you know, it was neat for them to do that. They brought back, you know, a bunch of the original writers of Deep Space Nine. And they sat in a writer's room and had the whiteboards, and they actually broke down... They spent an entire, I think it was like an afternoon, writing out what this one episode was going to be. And they put a lot of thought into it, a lot of callbacks, and so on and so forth. And some of the writers forgot some of the things that happened on the show, and they had to be reminded, no, we can't do that because of this, and we can't do that because of that. And some of the writers genuinely forgot that that happened, right? And which does happen. But I don't think they're doing that on the show. I really think that they're like, okay, this is the basic premise for this episode. Okay, you know... Rod Roddenberry, you go write two pages of dialogue, you know, you Alex Kurtzman, you go write a couple pages, Patrick Stewart, you can write a couple pages if you want, and they just kind of bring it all together, because, like, Picard does have some epic speeches in the show, which, for the most part, falls on deaf ears every time. Like, everyone kind of looks at him like he's an old lunatic or something. But I really think that's Patrick Stewart himself writing these speeches, because they're so Shakespearean and so epic that, you know, Patrick Stewart has to be part of that. But again, it, like, falls on deaf ears. Like Picard really is treated like shit, you know, by a lot of the characters on the show. And it just blows my mind. Like, we saw Starfleet headquarters, but we haven't seen one Starfleet ship in this whole series. Not one. We haven't, you know, like, there's, like, I'm assuming they're going to show up on the season finale. I'm thinking Riker's going to show up with a fleet of ships. I'm hoping, fingers crossed, but I don't know. But one thing I'm going to end on, did you ever watch that documentary Trekkies that they did, like, 21 years ago?
Yes, forever ago, but yes.
Yeah, and then he did a sequel, I think it was like 10 years later, like I want to say like 2009, yeah. They did a sequel. So I'm thinking this is the documentary I'm thinking of. So there's this one scene where there's this lady who has like a big crush on Data. I think this is from Trekkies. I might be wrong, this might be another documentary I'm thinking of, but I want to say it was Trekkies. Where she says, like, she likes Brent Spiner, she thinks he's handsome and stuff, but she's in love with Data, and she draws, like, pictures of Data, and she actually drew some, like, erotic pictures of Data, yes, and geez, Data and Yar.
Listen, forever, and they weren't that good either.
No, but Brent Spiner thought it was funny. Denise Crosby thought it was funny, because I think she got them signed by them. But anyway, I always thought that was interesting for whatever reason that she was in love with Data, not Brent Spiner. That she was attracted to Data, the android, and not Brent Spiner. I thought that, you know, that's interesting. In this episode, the actress, I believe her name is Iza Briones, if I've got that correct. She plays Daj and Soji, Data's daughters, using air quotes, for the series. So when you get to this android planet, you actually meet a different version of her, and this one is called Sutra. So it's played by the same actress, Iza Briones, but Sutra is in the Data makeup. Like, she has the gold skin, the yellow eyes, but she's looks like Daj and Soji, right? And you know, that actress is Briones is a very beautiful young woman. Like, she's very attractive, right? Holy crap, man. I did, like, now I completely understand where this lady's coming from. Seeing that actress in the Data makeup, wow. Now I know what she's talking about. She's, like, I mean, she, like I said, she's an attractive actress, but you see her in that, I don't know, maybe it's just me, maybe I'm crazy, maybe, I don't know, but she's so much hotter in that Data makeup. Like, it's crazy. I'm like, wow. You know, she's very reminiscent, like, if you remember Goldfinger, like the James Bond film, you know, when he paints that woman in the gold, that's what she kind of looks like in the show, and it's like, holy crap, like I don't know, that's just something that came to my mind, is like, now I understand where that woman was coming from when she said she was attracted to Data and not Brent Spiner, more Data than Brent Spiner, because, yeah, wow, I don't know what it is, but she looked so much better as Sutra, and she's the bad android, she's like the lore of these sisters, so... we'll see what happens in the final episode. But, all right, Kev, I think I call this an end to the episode. Okay. But before we go, let's play that little game of where can we find you on the internet. And, Kev, prior to recording, you said that you had a new venture on the go. Did you want to discuss that at all?
I can.
Excellent.
We're still working on a couple of things right now, but the first episode is already recorded. For those that don't know, I also write for a site called The Retro Network, and I've appeared as a guest on various podcasts. I actually, is it coming up Friday? Friday, as we record this, I'm on an episode of a podcast they have called Sequel Quest, which is write a fantasy sequel to a movie that never got one. And we're doing The Incredible Hulk, the Ed Norton movie.
Nice.
And everyone on the show does their own take on what they think a sequel would be, and then you kind of compile together at the end. But I will be launching my own show on the Retro Network, talking about pro wrestling and going through with everything shut down right now. We thought it was the perfect time to look back at some old wrestling shows. So as many of us are under stay-at-home orders, and about 25 years ago, the WWE started a pay-per-view series called In Your House. We are going through all 27 In Your House pay-per-views. Well, we are also stuck in our house.
Nice.
So, that upcoming podcast is going to be called The House Show, which is also what a non-televised wrestling event is called.
Excellent.
So it's me and two of my longtime friends. We've gone to wrestling together for years. We have like a group chat that we talk in every day, and I've been friends with them about 25 years as well, if not a little longer.
Excellent.
So yeah, I will be sharing that across all of my usual feeds, which my own site is masklibrary.com, and I am on I have a Facebook page, a Twitter, an Instagram. All of those are Mask Library.
Excellent. Looking forward to listening to those podcasts. That's awesome. On behalf of myself, you can check out my blog at www.randomnerdness.blogspot.com. I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at chrislock1701. That's C-H-R-I-S-L-O-C 1701. Be sure to check out the Pop Culture Pub podcast group on Facebook. Send a request to join, and I'm sure I'll approve it. We focus on positive pop culture news and discussions there. Last group count, we hit the 200 member mark. So we are at 200 members, which is awesome. And I'm hoping some of those new members are actually listeners of this podcast, because a few of the ones that I just approved to join the group, I have no idea who they are. They're nobody that I know. So I'm hoping that maybe they listen to this podcast.
And
I did have one of my friends joined.
Excellent.
So her name popped up for me to approve somehow.
Oh,
okay. I guess because we're friends.
Excellent. No, that's perfect. The more the merrier. Like I said, you know, it's a good group. I'm also the admin of the Incredible Fans of the Incredible Hulk. It's a group on Facebook. And our last group count on that group was 1,046 members. So if you're a fan of the Incredible Hulk, be sure to check out that group. So, on behalf of Kevin Decent and myself, Chris Lockhart, I want to thank you, dear listener, for taking the time to listen to the Pop Culture Pub podcast. This was our awful but good episode, and we will see you again for our next episode, which will be our Star Trek Picard Season 1 review. Good night.
I am inevitable.